I want to start this deep dive with a bit of a request. I want you to pause for a second and just visualize something really specific.
Okay, I'm playing along.
So, when I say the words free will, like when you picture yourself making a choice, any choice, what does that actually look like in your head?
I mean, if you're like most people, especially if you grew up in the modern West, you probably picture a blank slate, or maybe a switch.
Right. Yeah, that's exactly what I see. I picture myself standing in this kind of void. There's option A on the left, option B on the right.
And you're totally neutral.
Completely neutral, standing in a vacuum. Nothing is pushing me, and I just pick one. It feels like total independence.
And that is the classic default view for most of us. It's actually called libertarian liberty.
Which, to be clear, isn't about politics, right?
Right. It's not about politics at all. It's about metaphysics. It comes from 17th century thinkers, guys like William of Ockham and Descartes. And the whole idea is that the human will operates in a causal vacuum. It's an uncaused cause. You're just a completely independent agent flipping a switch.
But today, we are going to look at a source that says that entire picture is completely wrong. We're doing a deep dive into the moral psychology of Thomas Aquinas.
Based on a really fascinating lecture series by Dr. Arthur Holmes.
Right. And Aquinas argues that your will isn't a switch, it's a compass.
And I gotta say, that shift going from a switch to a compass, it changes everything.
It really
It
does.
changes how you understand your own bad habits, how you judge morality in really complex situations like war, and even how you define what it actually means to be happy.
So let's get into the machinery of this. Because if I'm not standing in a vacuum making neutral choices, what is actually happening?
Yeah.
Because it certainly feels like I'm making choices. I chose to drink coffee this morning. Nobody forced me to do that.
You are making choices, absolutely. But Aquinas says you aren't choosing from a neutral position. He defines the will not as a neutral switch, but as intellectual inclination.
Intellectual inclination. That sounds a bit heavy. Let's decode that for a second.
Well, think of a bent wire. If you put a bent wire on a table, it has a natural shape, right? A leaning.
Yeah, it wants to roll a certain way.
Exactly. Aquinas believes the human will has a nature. It is magnetically pulled towards something specific. It's not empty, it's hungry.
The source material used a really helpful comparison here to explain why we think so differently about this now. It contrasted a mechanistic worldview with a teleological one.
Right, and this is crucial context. The modern view, the one we usually hold without even thinking about it, is mechanistic. Think of the universe like a giant pool table.
The billiard ball
The
universe.
billiard ball universe, yeah. In that world, things only move if they get hit from behind.
Right.
Cause and effect is just a chain of impacts. It's all about past forces pushing things around. So if you want to be free in that universe, you have to be outside the chain of pumping balls.
You have to be in a vacuum.
You have to be in a vacuum.
But Aquinas is operating in a teleological universe, which comes from the Greek word telos, meaning an end or a goal or a purpose.
Yes. In Aquinas's universe, things aren't just pushed from behind by blind forces. They are lured forward by goals. They have a destination they're actively trying to reach.
So the will isn't just reacting to a push, it's chasing something.
Precisely. It's an appetite. And this is where the theology grounds the psychology. Aquinas argues that God is the cause of all causes.
The ultimate cause.
Right. He is the efficient cause that powers the whole system. But, and this is the part that preserves our humanity.
Yeah.
He empowers us as secondary causes.
So we aren't puppets. We are real agents, but we're agents within a system, not totally outside of it.
Correct. We don't exist in a vacuum. In the source lecture, Dr. Holmes mentions a scholar named Westberg who makes a really great point.
Oh, I loved this part.
Yeah, Westberg suggests that when Aquinas talks about the will, he's talking about something very similar to the biblical concept of the heart.
Like that verse, out of the heart flow the issues of life.
It's the perfect parallel. The heart isn't just a physical muscle in this context. It's the guiding core of the personality. It's the motivating force.
And for Aquinas, that core has a natural set. It is oriented.
Exactly.
Okay, so if my will is a compass and it's being lured forward, what is the magnet? Where is north?
This is the beautiful and honestly somewhat tragic part of Aquinas' psychology. We are magnetically oriented toward the good.
The good, capital G.
Capital G, good. Aquinas is echoing St. Augustine here. There's that famous line from the Confessions.
Thou hast made us for thyself, O God, and our hearts are restless till they rest in thee.
That's the one. Aquinas takes that poetic theological idea and turns it into a metaphysical fact. The human will is built with a default setting. It wants happiness. It wants fulfillment. It wants God.
That is a massive claim, though, because it implies that you literally cannot will yourself to be miserable.
You can't. You cannot choose something purely because you think it will destroy you. You can only choose it because you think, in some twisted way, it's good for you.
Wait, hold on. That sounds nice on paper, but it doesn't really seem to match reality. People choose miserable things all the time.
They do.
People stay in toxic relationships. They destroy their health with addiction. They hurt people they love. If we are hardwired for the good, why is the world full of so much bad?
That is the million-dollar question. If the compass points north, why are we constantly walking south?
Right.
To understand that, we have to look at the actual machinery of the soul. Aquinas says we have the engine and we have the steering wheel.
Okay, help me out with the mechanics here. Which is which?
The will is the engine. It provides the drive, the urge, the want. But the intellect is the steering wheel.
Okay.
The will drives us toward what the intellect perceives to be good.
Perceives. That seems like the danger zone.
It absolutely is.
Yeah.
But before we get to where it goes wrong, we should probably look at the layers of the soul. Because we aren't just floating intellects.
True. Aquinas breaks it down biologically, right?
He does. We have the animal soul, which is sensory.
This is the part I share with my dog.
Right. And it has two distinct modes or drives. First, there's the concupiscible.
Which sounds like a delicious word, honestly.
It does, and that's appropriate.
Hmm.
Concupiscible comes from the Latin for strong desire. It's the drive for what is pleasing. Food, sex, comfort, a warm bed. It's the pure, I want that drive.
And the second mode?
The irascible.
Now, that sounds like irritable, like someone who desperately needs a nap.
It's related. But in Aquinas' view, it's actually much more noble than that. The irascible appetite is the resistance to what is threatening or difficult.
Oh, like the fight in fight or flight?
Exactly. It's the part of you that gets angry at an obstacle and wants to overcome it. It's endurance.
Okay, so we have these animal drives. Chasing pleasure, the concupiscible, and fighting difficulty, the irascible. But we aren't just animals.
No, we have the rational soul. We have an intellect that can look beyond just immediate sensory pleasure and understand abstract concepts. Things like good, truth, justice, eternity.
And ideally, the rational soul should be holding the steering wheel, guiding those animal drives.
Ideally, yes.
But here's where it gets really interesting and honestly a little frightening. If we are hardwired for the good and we have this rational brain, why do people do terrible things? Why is there evil?
This is the glitch. And Aquinas' answer is fascinating.
Mm.
He argues that we never, ever choose evil as evil.
Never. Even the villain in a movie. Even a historical tyrant.
Even them. Aquinas would say that person is deeply confused. They are seeking something they perceive as a good.
Like what?
Maybe power, maybe autonomy, national security, or even just the thrill of dominance.
Mm.
They're chasing a perceived good, but their map is completely wrong.
The source brought up a quote from Milton's Paradise Lost that gave me chills. It's Satan speaking.
Evil be thou my good.
That is profound, because he doesn't say I love being evil. He says, I am going to call this evil thing good so that I can pursue it.
Yes.
It's a tragedy of mistaken identity.
Exactly. Aquinas calls this pursuing a lesser good at the expense of the ultimate good. It's basically a form of idolatry.
So idolatry isn't necessarily bowing down to a golden statue. It's a substitution problem.
Yes. It's making money or power or a relationship or your reputation, your God. You aren't hating good. You're getting stuck in the middle.
Right.
You want happiness, which is the ultimate good, but your intellect gets tricked into thinking that this specific promotion or this specific revenge will finally deliver it.
So the will is still doing its job. It's driving the car toward the good. But the intellect is reading the map wrong.
Or the map has been tampered with. Dr. Holmes discusses the theology of the fall of man here. He explains that Aquinas distinguishes between the image of God and the likeness of God.
I've heard those terms used interchangeably my whole life.
Usually they are. But Aquinas splits them to explain the glitch. He says we kept the image.
Meaning our raw machinery.
Right. We still have an intellect and a will. We are still rational agents.
Yeah.
But we lost the likeness. We lost the moral character and the correct orientation.
So the compass still spins, but the needle is demagnetized. It doesn't point true north anymore.
And the deceiver, another term Holmes uses, plays on that. We get confused.
Mm.
We rationalize. We let our animal soul overpower our rational soul because the immediate pleasure of the concupiscible drive screams way louder than the quiet truth of the intellect.
This really shifts how you look at bad people or even your own bad habits. It's not necessarily pure malice. It's a malfunction of perception.
It is. And that leads us to how we actually judge right and wrong in this system. Because if intentions and perceptions matter so much, ethics can't just be a list of black and white rules on a wall.
Right. Which brings us to a really practical but kind of heavy concept in the lecture, the doctrine of double intention, or sometimes it's called double effect.
This is a cornerstone of Thomistic ethics. And it's actually still used today, especially in military ethics and medical ethics. It deals with those messy, real-world situations where there is no clean option.
So the idea is that you can do one action that has two effects, one good, one bad, and the morality of the action depends on which effect you intended.
Correct. The classic example Dr. Holmes gives is from war.
Okay, lay it out for us.
Imagine a soldier needs to destroy a bridge to stop an unjust, aggressive army from invading a city. That is the primary intention. Stop the aggression, restore peace.
But destroying the bridge might kill civilians who happen to be crossing it at that exact moment.
That is the secondary intention, or the collateral damage. Now, in the modern world, we often just look at the outcome and say, civilians died, therefore the action was evil.
Not just a pure calculation.
Exactly. But Aquinas looks at the will.
Because the will is the heart.
Precisely. If the soldier's goal, his primary intent, was to kill those civilians to terrorize the enemy, that is an evil act. It is morally culpable.
Right.
But if his goal was to stop the army, and the civilian deaths were a known but unintended side effect that he deeply regrets,
then the moral weight is completely different.
It is. It's still a tragedy, obviously. But it isn't the same kind of moral evil as deliberately targeting the innocent.
That feels risky, though, doesn't it? Couldn't I just do whatever I want and say, oh, I didn't intend the bad part?
You can lie to others, sure. And you can definitely lie to yourself. But in Aquinas' worldview, you are ultimately dealing with God, who is the searcher of hearts.
You can't fool the manufacturer about how the machine is running.
Exactly. The doctrine isn't a loophole. It's actually a call to extreme internal honesty.
So if the will is a compass, and we're trying to navigate this incredibly complex world where bridges have to be blown up and lesser goods are constantly masquerading as ultimate goods, what is the destination? What is the goal of life for Aquinas?
This is where he really breaks from his intellectual hero, Aristotle. They agree on a lot of the mechanics, but they completely diverge on the finish line.
How so?
Well, for Aristotle, the ultimate goal was to be a philosopher, to live a life of perfect reason and contemplation.
Which sounds nice, but maybe a bit exclusive. If you aren't brilliant, wealthy, and living a life of leisure in Athens, you're kind of out of luck.
That's the exact critique. It's elitist. For Aquinas, the goal isn't to be a philosopher. The goal is to be a saint, to be like God.
And how do we get there? What's the toolkit?
It's a combination of nature and grace. First, you have the cardinal virtues. These are natural. You don't have to be a Christian or religious at all to have them.
These were the big four, right?
Yeah.
Justice, wisdom, courage, and self-control.
Right. Aquinas says these are accessible to everyone because of natural law. But then, to truly reach the ultimate good, to actually reach God, you need the theological virtues.
Which are gifts of grace.
Yes. Faith, hope, and love.
I want to circle back to natural law for a second, because that term gets thrown around a lot today, mostly in political debates. But Dr. Holmes had this handout in the lecture that broke down the hierarchy of inclinations.
Oh, that handout is brilliant.
It really is. It makes it sound so biological.
It is biological. That's the beauty of Thomistic thought. Aquinas doesn't separate the physical world from the moral world. He says natural law is written on our hearts, corresponding to what we actually are as creatures.
So level one is just the fact that we are stuff, we are matter.
Yes, the universal inclination. Everything in the universe wants to keep existing. A rock resists being crushed. A tree reaches for sunlight.
So the first precept of natural law is self-preservation.
Exactly. Suicide, for instance, violates this most basic rock-bottom law of existence. Good is to be done and evil is to be avoided, starting right there at mere survival.
And then level two is the animal.
Right. We are biological creatures. So things like reproduction, raising offspring, eating, sleeping, those are natural goods. They're built into our biology.
And then the top level, the human level.
The rational inclination. This is the drive to know the truth, specifically the truth about God, and to live in a just, cooperative society.
I love how it builds on itself. It's not like the spiritual part cancels out the animal part.
No, not at all. And that's a famous Thomistic maxim. Grace does not destroy nature, but perfects it.
Explain that, perfects it.
Well, think about eating. The desire to eat is level two. It's an animal drive. And it's good. Aquinas doesn't want you to starve. But if you only follow that drive without the rational level, You become a glutton. You make food your ultimate goal.
Idolatry again. The lesser good.
Exactly. Grace comes in not to tell you don't eat, but to orient that desire. So that eating becomes a way to sustain yourself for the higher good. It magnetizes the needle again.
It aligns the rock bottom survival instinct and the animal instinct with the rational desire for God.
Yes. The whole system works in harmony.
So we've gone from the will as a compass to the tragic confusion of chasing lesser goods, all the way to the high calling of becoming a saint through virtue. It really is a complete architecture of the soul.
It is. And what I find most compelling about Aquinas and why I think this source material is so relevant today is that he integrates everything.
Yeah.
In a modern world, we constantly separate facts from values.
Yeah.
We separate what is from what ought to be.
Yeah. Science tells us what we are. DNA, neurons, chemical reactions, and philosophy or religion tells us what we should do. And they live in totally different buildings and never talk to each other.
Exactly. But for Aquinas, they're the exact same building. Being good isn't about following some arbitrary rule book dropped from the sky. It is fulfilling your natural design.
Right.
A good rock is a rock that stays hard and persists. A good heart is a heart that pumps blood effectively. And a good human is a human who seeks truth and loves God. Morality is literally just the operator's manual for being fully human.
That is such a refreshing way to look at it. It takes the anxiety and the pressure off of just following the rules and puts the focus on functioning properly.
And it reminds us that our desires, even our most messed up, destructive desires, start from a place of wanting something good.
We're just really bad at identifying what that good actually is.
Exactly.
So as we wrap up this deep dive, here's something I want you to carry with you today. If Aquinas is right, and we always pursue what we perceive as good, then nobody wakes up trying to be a villain. We're all just chasing happiness, often with a broken map.
It raises a very uncomfortable question for self-reflection.
It really does. We usually ask ourselves, what did I do wrong today? But maybe the much better, deeper question is, what lesser good are you currently chasing that is masquerading as the ultimate good?
Is it your career? Your comfort?
Being right in an argument.
Because whatever it is, if it's not the ultimate good, it will never satisfy the hunger of a heart that was made for the infinite.
And on that note, we'll leave you to check your own compass. Thanks for joining us on the deep dive.
See you next time.